The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 131, a play, Survival of the Fittest, by Tom Duncan, with readers Dane Allred, Margie Duncan, Tom Duncan, Jane Flynn, Michael Flynn, and Tim Hansen.
We have a reading for us today, Clovis and Eunice Thudpucker, Elmer Watkins, Margot Winterhager, and Thurston Wheelis. Just thought you'd like to know that. In deference to also the fact that this is Sunstone. You've come here for spiritual food and intellectual food. We also realize that physical food is important to you, so we're not going to take you into the lunch hour. We're doing a shortened version of the show today so that we can get it done in about an hour and 15 minutes. Maybe have some discussion afterwards if you'd like to. And we'll try to be done by, 12:45, I think, is our time. And without further ado, we'll just get right into it.
Survival of the Fittest, a play by Tom Duncan. List of characters in order of appearance. Ralph Chamberlain, age 30, head of biology department, BYU. Horace Hall Cummings, age 45, superintendent of church schools. Joseph F. Smith, age 70, president of the LDS Church. George H. Brimhall, age 50, president of BYU. Flora Brimhall, age 27, polygamous wife to George Brimhall. Henry Peterson, 30s, supervisor, College of Education, BYU. Joseph Peterson, 30s, head of psychology department. James E. Talmadge, age 45, an apostle of the LDS Church. Setting. The action occurs between the years of 1909 and 1911 in Provo, BYU, and various locales, and Salt Lake City, LDS Church headquarters. The stage is divided into several levels or lighted areas representing various locales where the action takes place. Smith's office, consisting of a table, a telephone, a desk, and some chairs in front and behind the desk. Brimhall's office, of similar furnishings to Smith's office, with the addition of an umbrella stand near the door. A waiting room outside Brimhall's office, complete with a few chairs against a wall. Various other locales at church offices and Brigham Young University. Central to all these locales is an area containing a podium with a banner behind it on which are painted the words Charles Darwin Centennial, Brigham Young University, 12 February 1909. Act 1, Scene 1. Setting, the podium, darkness. At rise, lights up as Ralph steps into the light and behind the podium.
On this day throughout America, we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of our beloved Abraham Lincoln. By happy coincidence, this is also the centennial of the birth of Charles Darwin. And the civilized world is uniting in paying tribute to him and his greatness and in acknowledging its indebtedness to him. It is primarily as Americans and as patriots that we are moved with admiration and love for Abraham Lincoln. It is as members of the broader brotherhood of mankind that we must honor and revere the memory of Darwin. So long as the present race of men shall last and the continuity of intellectual and moral progress be not wholly broken, so long will Darwin's influence be felt and merit for him from his fellows admiration, gratitude, and reverence, and a place among the greatest of their kind.
Scene 2. Setting, Smith's office, LDS Church headquarters. At rise, lights up on President of the LDS Church, Joseph F. Smith, sitting at the table reading some papers. Horace H. Cummings, Church Commissioner of Education, is seated near Smith's desk. Cummings carries a leather case under his arm. His demeanor throughout the scene is obsequious to the extreme. Smith continues reading for just a bit, then stops, takes off his glasses, looks up.
I have a formal request from the board that you, as a president of the Board of Education, and ultimately as the final voice in all university matters, reconsider instituting football as a viable school sport.
What did you tell them when they asked you about the situation?
Yes, I reminded them that my predecessor, Carl G. Mazur, under the direction of President Woodrow, had officially banned the sport, calling it, I quote, "a barbarous, brutal exercise not to be dignified by the title of a game," end quote. And then I quoted from them the words of Superintendent Goddard, and I quote, "I cannot find one particle of good arising from indulgence in either yells or football games, but can see a great amount of evil. I advise utter abandonment of the sport by all Latter-day Saints," end quote.
And that wasn't good enough for them?
President, they thought that perhaps, whereas several years have passed since that incident of 1897...
Incident, I suppose you're referring to that that game that ended in a slugging match on Christmas Day, mind you.
Yes, well...
Just wanted to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
Anyway, since it is, and it has been several years, it was felt that perhaps you might have changed your mind.
We haven't.
And I, of course, concur. I absolutely concur. However, I did feel it was my duty to at least make you aware.
We believe now, as did our predecessor, that any sport that would lead our young men who are supposed to be preparing themselves to serve as ministers of the Lord Jesus Christ into drinking, swearing, and engaging in fisticuffs should not be indulged in. The elevated standards of Mormonism are entirely incompatible with the base and savage posturings of football. Brother Cummings, you may tell the Board of Trustees that our mind has not changed on this matter. Now, about this other matter.
Yes. Well.
Brother Cummings, we've gone over your preliminary report.
Yes. Well.
And let us say, first of all, that as superintendent of church schools, you're doing a very fine job.
Thank you, President Smith.
Yes, fine job indeed.
I do take my job seriously, President, and like my mentor, Brother Mazur, I do believe that the value of church education is in the development of the spiritual rather than the intellectual capacities of man.
As do we, Brother Cummings. So we view the conclusions of your report with the same apprehensions as do you.
Yes, well.
As you know, the Young University was begun by President Young as a protest, you might call it, against the secular schools of the world, and we are not prepared now to relinquish that charge. We must continue on, however difficult that battle may seem from time to time. So it pains us greatly to learn of the fact that evolution is being taught at the university.
Well, then perhaps you might be interested in to hear the contents of a letter I received just about an hour ago.
By all means, you most certainly would be interested.
This is from a disgruntled father. "When my daughter was home for the holidays, I found there was something wrong in school in regards to Professor Edwin S. Hinckley's geology class. Hinckley has mixed up evolution with geology, and my daughter got the wrong idea that man originated from the monkey or that all animals originated from the jellyfish. I hope she has a misunderstanding in regards to this, but if not, I thought it was my duty to let you know about it."
Brother Cummings, are there any other teachers who are doing the same?
I have reports that there are, but no names to this point.
What to this point have you done about it?
Well, in regards to the letter, I have been in communication with President Brimhall, and he has assured me in a letter that the young girl must have gotten the wrong impression. Mm-hmm. He insists that neither the academy nor any of the teachers believe or accept the doctrine of man's ancestors being the lower animals.
I see, but you've come to us, isn't this true, because you don't believe that statement?
Well, I've received too many complaints to believe this is just an isolated matter. Which is not to say that I think President Brimhall is misrepresenting the facts, by any means, no. No, it's just that what with all the matters on campus that he must deal with, perhaps he has fallen out of touch with his faculty members.
Yeah. Those things do happen within a large organization. I mean, goodness knows, the church has its own share of problems in that area. Now, Brother Cummings, we want you to go down to Provo and fully investigate this matter. Find out which teachers are teaching evolution and assess the damage, if any, that such teaching is causing.
Scene 3, setting the podium. At Rise, Ralph continues his speech from the first scene.
Darwin was strong and exceedingly active physically, and in things of the mind, his tastes were broad. He loved hard and intellectual work, and a complex subject pleased him more than an easy one. The clear geometrical proofs of Euclid delighted him, and the work in chemistry held him till late hours. He sat for hours reading Shakespeare, Milton, Scott, and Byron. He greatly admired some odes of Horace. And even later, when, on his voyage around the world, when only one good book could be carried with him on expedition, he chose Milton.
Scene 4, setting, Brimhall's office. At Rise, the lights up on George Brimhall, president of Brigham Young University. Sitting at the desk, picks up a phone.
Well, who's next on the list? Has he arrived yet? Well, send Brother Chamberlain as soon as he gets here. She is. Let her in.
Flora enters. They embrace.
Flora, how happy I am to see you, but why are you here? I've told you many times.
Not to be seen in public. I know, George, since the manifesto has reduced all of us second wives to living in a seclusion.
Now, Flora.
Not even able to be seen in public with our lawful husbands. I realize I'm endangering you, the university, the church, and myself, but...
Dear, sweet Flora, what's the matter? You can tell George.
I'm sorry, George. It's just that the only time I get to see you is when you can manage to get away from things and at the university. You have to go through all kinds of effort to hide your tracks so the federal agents won't discover what you're doing. I feel like a mistress instead of your wife. As a matter of fact, it would be easier if I were your mistress. The government wouldn't care if you were seeing a whore on the side. But a second wife, throw the adulterer in jail.
I understand how you feel, Flora, but what can I do?
I don't know.
And it's not as if I'm the only one who's forced to neglect his family. I mean, all the brethren who live the principal.
I know, dear, but that doesn't make it any easier. George, when you asked me to be your second wife, I was so happy. I couldn't imagine that anyone could be happier than I was. And happy wasn't the only thing I felt. I felt honored that a man like you would want a girl like me for a wife. You don't know how much I idolized you.
Yes, I do.
Come on.
No, I do. I really do. I saw you looking at me there in the theology class.
I never.
Yes, you did. I mean, I would move away from the podium to drive home a particular salient point of my lecture, and your eyes would follow.
Well, of course. I was watching you. You were the instructor.
No, but it was more than that. Sometimes during reading assignments, I'd see you hazard a glance in my direction.
For you to see that, you must have been looking at me.
Well, I was. I was quite smitten with you, actually.
Do forgive me for coming out of the clear blue like this. I just couldn't wait until next weekend.
Is everything all right? Do you need any money, or are the children all right?
Yes, I have enough. And yes, the children are fine. I just needed to be reminded that I'm important, that I actually exist, that I'm not just an ornament you keep on a shelf in Spanish Fork.
And have you been reminded?
Something's troubling you.
Hmm? Well, it just seems that in my efforts to upgrade the faculty at this institution by hiring doctors of philosophy in various disciplines, I have inadvertently opened a Pandora's box of troubles.
What sort of troubles?
Well, certain instructors on campus have been teaching the theory of evolution with, it would appear, a little more enthusiasm than such a theory warrants.
I don't know much about evolution, and I couldn't care less, to tell you the truth. But I do know you, George Brimhall. You'll manage. You always do.
Suddenly, Brimhall clutches his stomach in pain.
Your stomach again? How long has it been bothering you this time?
I'll be all right. It's just my cross to bear.
It and me.
Well, and this university. Other men should be so lucky. I'll be all right. I just have to excuse myself for a moment.
Brimhall exits, running and clutching his stomach. We hear retching from off stage. Flora moves to investigate when Ralph enters. Flora whirls. Ralph stops suddenly upon seeing her. Their eyes meet in the midst of an awkward pause.
Flora, Sister Brimhall.
Ralph.
They told me to just come in.
How are you?
As well as can be expected, I suppose, under the circumstances.
Circumstances? Yes, circumstances. Are you talking about the impending visit of the superintendent of church schools?
Yes, the coming of Horace Cummings. So George has told you all about it.
Oh, not at all. George seldom tells me anything. He wears the presidency of this university like the mantle of a prophet. What happens at BYU is far too important to burden a wife with, especially a second wife.
I understand.
Do you?
Yes, I suppose you do, being the Eastern intellectual that you are.
What are you talking about?
You must know how much you and your colleagues are held in suspicion.
Suspicion of what? That will bring too much of the world into Zion?
There's too much of the world in Zion as it is.
Not enough, as far as I'm concerned.
Ralph Chamberlain, how you've changed.
In what way?
You mean you really don't know? You're not at all the optimistic zealot you were back at the U. You wear your contempt for tradition on your sleeve.
Like the mantle of the prophet, you mean?
A radical with a cause. How intriguing.
What's wrong with being a radical? Jesus Christ was a radical, so was Joseph Smith.
And you are neither of those men, unless I missed the announcement at the last general conference.
The church itself used to be radical. Doesn't it strike you odd that a religion that less than a generation ago was one of the most revolutionary forces for religious and societal change in the world should today be slipping into respectability without a fight?
Don't forget that one of the major features of the 19th century radicals was plural marriage, a principle which, unless I miss my guess, you despise.
You've caught me. I'm riddled with inconsistency.
Sound of Brimhall retching off stage.
Is he all right?
Just some indigestion. It'll pass.
I suppose all this campus controversy is wearing on him.
You don't have to worry about George Brimhall. He's a rugged man.
I meant no disrespect. Please understand. Flora, do you ever regret it? The fact that both the church and the government seem to have conspired against your happiness?
Is that it, you think? A conspiracy? Or is it just that I'm a victim of a bygone age? An age when people could live their religion and not have their rights trampled on by their own government?
Do you ever wonder what it would have been like if... Well, if you know, if the two of us...
Oh, dear. Oh, sweet Ralph, I think you've done wondering enough for both of us. And look at all the trouble it's caused.
Brimhall enters. He wipes his face on a handkerchief and shakes Ralph's hand.
Oh, Chamberlain. Glad you could make it.
Well, I'd best be off.
Gathers up her coat and umbrella, wraps a scarf around her head.
There. Do you think I'm disguised enough? Will the feds recognize me?
Gives Brimhall a kiss on the cheek, nods to Ralph.
Nice to see you again, Ralph.
The pleasure was mine. Let me assure you.
Flora exits.
Her being here, I hope, didn't make you uncomfortable. I'm not unaware of the feelings you once had for Flora, you know.
On the contrary, it was a bit like old times.
Old times. Yeah, I could use some of that myself. But unfortunately, the future we have to deal with, specifically the visit to our campus by Brother Horace Hall Cummings. I assume you've heard all about it?
Well, what I've heard doesn't please me, I can tell you that much.
Well, take a seat and let's talk about it.
What's this all about, George?
And I sense some alarm in your question, Ralph. There's no need for that. This is purely a formality. Let me get straight to the point. I'm expecting Superintendent Cummings any minute now. He's asked me to speak with several of you brethren, in particular about...
Evolution. Higher criticism, is that it?
Yes, there is some concern at higher levels that...
Has someone complained?
No, not someone. Several. Superintendent Cummings just wants to ask you a few questions.
What about?
Well, why don't we wait till he gets here? I mean, it would be useless to speculate on his intentions.
Why? He's speculating on mine, isn't he?
You seem overly anxious, Ralph. I mean, this is not an inquisition. That sort of thing doesn't happen in the true church. When the superintendent gets here, all you have to do is tell him your side of the story, and I'm sure he'll understand.
Very well. I'll withhold judgment until the superintendent arrives.
Yeah, that's a sensible.
Then I'll give him a piece of my mind.
Oh. Ralph, how much do you know about Horace Hall Cummings?
Actually, not very much.
And normally, would you ever have occasion to know much about him? His responsibility is primarily with those of us entrusted with the administration of the church's schools, and he takes that responsibility very seriously, as well he should. I think we can both agree on that.
Yes, of course.
Brother Cummings is, for the most part, a self-educated man. Just between you and me, I don't think he fully understands our mission here at the Brigham Young University. He has, a mistrust of persons with advanced degrees. The reason for that, I suppose, is his failed attempt to obtain an advanced degree himself. Not to mention that he claims to have received a blessing from one of Orson Hyde's widows, in tongues, mind you, that he would be a great tool in setting in order the church's educational institutions or some such.
Are you suggesting he's on some sort of a divine witch hunt?
Well, I want you to know something, Ralph. And I mean this very sincerely. You and the Patterson brothers are the first three PhDs this school has ever had. As such, you all hold a special place in the yet-to-be-written history of this institution. I am in no way opposed to either your curriculum or the way in which you teach it. I've conducted my own studies of the theories of Charles Darwin, and I do not find them in the least harmful to one's faith in God. The truth be known, I'm somewhat of an evolutionist myself.
Well, that's reassuring to know.
So, when you called in to talk with Brother Horace Hall Cummings, know that I stand behind you squarely.
Of course.
Then, we should have no problem at all. Thank you for coming in.
Ralph exits. Brimhall holds his composure for a little bit, then he can stand it no longer. He collapses in his chair in pain as the lights dim. Flashback begins. Cummings enters, stands just inside the light. Brimhall looks up with a pained expression.
I'm somewhat of an evolutionist myself.
I was speaking in the spirit of camaraderie, you understand.
Just between you and me, I don't think he fully understands our mission here at Brigham Young University.
Well, and isn't there the element of truth in that? I mean, that's why you've come, isn't it? To learn the truth of things here.
Yes, well, and it certainly seemed to start off rather well. I speak of our meeting earlier this morning.
Lights up full, Brimhall's pain disappears. He is now fully in flashback.
You mentioned in your letter to me the nature of your visit, this evolution business.
Precisely. I've been sent by the First Presidency to investigate the situation here and to make any suggestions for improvement I deem necessary to realign this school with its stated purpose, which is, as I'm sure you know, we have enough and to spare at present in these mountains of schools where young infidels are made because the teachers are so tender-footed that they dare not mention the principles of the gospel to the students. I will be visiting various classes to observe for myself if I have been told the truth.
Yes, well, I can assure you, as I did in my letter, that these stories are greatly exaggerated. All of my faculty are righteous men who faithfully follow the teachings of the church.
I hope you're right, President Brimhall, because you see, it would be a sad day in Zion if I were to discover that such heresies were being taught at the Lord's University.
I would hardly call the theory of evolution heresy, Superintendent.
You have read the First Presidency's statement on that subject, have you not?
Yes, I have. It's right here, as a matter of fact, and I found no clear refutation of evolution contained in it.
Well, I admit the First Presidency was not very specific in that matter.
The statement defends, from my point of view, a physical as well as a spiritual creation.
But with Adam as primal parent of the race, created in the image of God, such are not the views of Charles Darwin.
Yes, that may be so.
President Brimhall, I have here a whole sheaf of documents, letters to me from as far away as northern Mexico, concerning certain teachings that are not sitting well with the parents who have entrusted the spiritual and emotional well-being of their students into our care. In these letters, there are several teachers who are named whose classes I will be visiting this week, among others. They are Ralph V. Chamberlain and Henry and Joseph Peterson.
Well, rest assured that these brethren have impeccable credentials from some of the best colleges in the East, and their faithfulness to the teachings of the church cannot be denied.
Previous faithfulness and good character are no assurance against the loss of one's faith. I'm sure you will agree, President Brimhall.
Yes, of course.
Yes. Yeah. If the reports I have received are true, the theories of the Petersons and the Chamberlains seem to portend a move away from the religious simplicity and gospel purity that I am duty-bound to protect. Yes, well, I've taken enough of your time. I would appreciate it if you would tell your faculty that I will be observing their classes, talking to students for the next few days. They are to carry on as if I'm not there.
I don't think you have anything to worry about, Superintendent. While I believe that the Petersons and the Chamberlains are, from their point of view, perfectly right, still, I think they are perhaps a trifle, overzealous in their desires to bring people to their point of view. As they look at it, their teachings are in perfect harmony with the principles of the gospel, and therefore it seems to me a little patience will be in keeping with greater wisdom on their part.
Yes. Well.
Lights down on Cummings, dim on Brimhall. Brimhall clutches his stomach and, letting out a great sigh of agony, crumples in pain.
Scene 5, setting the podium. At Rise, Ralph behind the podium continues his speech.
Darwin was next sent to Christ College in the University of Cambridge with a view to preparing himself for the career of a clergyman. It was characteristic of the young man that he took this step only after making sure that he could conscientiously support the 39 Articles of Faith. When speaking of his education experiments, he later wrote, "My time was wasted, so far as academic studies were concerned, as completely at Edinburgh or at school." To this sweeping statement, however, he accepts the study made of Paley's work, Evidences of Christianity, Moral Philosophy, and Natural Theology.
Scene 6, setting, a waiting room outside Brimhall's office. At Rise, Joseph Peterson and Ralph Chamberlain sit in two chairs in the waiting room while Henry Peterson paces nervously.
How long has Harvey been in there? Cummings must really be raking him over the coals.
There's nothing to worry about. Just relax. President Brimhall assured me he would stand behind us no matter what.
And you believe that? It was that Judson student. That's who it was. I saw it on his face. He's the one. I could read the expression on his face. He kept looking at me as though I were preaching blasphemy.
I'm serious, Henry. You need to calm down. I mean, if indeed Brother Cummings is after our hides, which, by the way, I don't believe, showing fear is the worst thing.
Oh, for heaven's sakes, Joe. I'm supervisor of the College of Education. I've served on the study school board. The fact that he's even thinking of talking to me, well, it's somehow insulting.
I know.
And he's talking to everyone on campus. It's not as though he's singling us out.
Cummings enters.
Brother Ralph Chamberlain, whenever you're ready.
I'll be right there.
Ralph stands as Cummings goes back into his office.
Ralph, just one question before you go in. Where do you want to be buried?
Lights down on waiting room, up on Brimhall's office. Cummings is seated at Brimhall's desk.
Ralph V. Chamberlain, you certainly have some very interesting credentials. You joined the faculty in 1908. Previously, you had been the chair of the University of Utah's biology department and dean of its medical school?
That's correct, sir.
My old alma mater. I received a degree in education in 1906 from there. Yes, let's see, what else? Yes, you graduated from the University of Utah and taught math, science, language, and biology at the LDS College in Salt Lake City. So teaching at the BYU is not the first experience you've had with the church educational system.
No, sir.
So one would think that you would be familiar with the church's, shall we say, a unique position on the education of our youth.
Yes, sir.
After teaching these classes at the LDS College, you continued your graduate studies at Stanford and then at Cornell, receiving your doctorate in 1905. And you are currently the chairman of BYU's biology department.
That's all correct.
Yes. Well, let's get on to the business at hand.
Very well, Elder Cummings.
Oh, please, please. There's no need for such formality. Superintendent Cummings would be sufficient. Yes. You have taught classes, as I understand it. Am I correct on the Bible here at the BYU?
Yes, I have, and I enjoyed it very much.
And did you teach the Bible in the Orthodox manner, as the Sunday schools teach it, as the Word of God, so far as it is translated correctly? Is that the Bible that you taught?
Since I'm a teacher of college-age students, I feel it my duty to teach the Bible in greater depth than they do in Sunday school.
Is it not true that you use a teaching scholarly technique known as higher criticism? What is the exact definition of higher criticism?
Well, basically, higher criticism examines the Bible more as a book of literature, not so much as a book of scripture.
So which is it, the Bible, I mean, literature or scripture?
It is both, sir. Some of the greatest poetry in the English language comes from the Bible.
Well, that's true. The Psalms comes to mind.
Yes, sir. Very beautiful, sir, and very inspirational.
Did you not once refer to the book of Job as a work of fiction?
Not exactly. That is to say, I said something to the effect that it didn't matter whether the book of Job was fact or fiction. The story it tells of man's endurance in the face of great adversity is, in essence, true regardless.
And yet you find no fault in telling the youth of the church that a certain book of Holy Writ is false?
The prophet Joseph said that the Song of Solomon was not an inspired work.
Yes, he did. But Joseph was a prophet of God. As far as I know, you are still a PhD. Unless Harvard is handing out higher degrees than I had heard.
It was an intellectual exercise. I was hoping that by standing back, so to speak, my students could gain a better understanding of the overall themes of faithfulness that to God that are shown in the book of Job.
Well, let me ask you this question. How do you interpret passages of Scripture, Brother Chamberlain, if it is not by listening to what the prophets have to say about them?
When a passage of Scripture taken literally contradicts a fundamental natural law, I take it as allegorical. And in absence of divine authority, put a construction on it that seems to harmonize with my experience and reason.
Allow me to quote from the writings of George Q. Canis, specifically from the Deseret Evening News, October 8, 1893. The kind of evolution we believe in is that of man until he shall become a god, not the evolution of man from some low type of animal life. How do you feel about that?
The statement is true, at least the first part is. I believe that man has the potential of evolving into a god, but I also believe that President Cannon would not have made that statement if he understood the concepts of evolution as I do. Evolution explains not only the origin of life, but also the growth of man's belief in God, line upon line, precept upon precept, if you will.
You are aware that some students and authorities in the church disagree with your interpretation of the theory of evolution.
Well, not everyone agreed with me when I was a missionary. I have no problem with that. I'm not out to win a popularity contest.
Well, then you should have no problem with the fact that a predecessor of yours, theology professor Joseph B. Keeler, taught in 1891 that fossils of extinct life forms were nothing more than the remains of other planets which were broken up and remodeled and made into the one in which we live. What do you have to say to that theory?
That the Earth was made from spare parts from God's workshop. I fail to see why you find it so difficult to accept evolution if you can give that theory any credence.
Yes. Well, I believe we have come to the end of our little conversation. I will be here for 9 days, so I suppose I will see you again.
Yes, I suppose you will.
Definitely Tuesday at your theology class.
Ralph exits into the waiting room. Joseph and Henry stand.
All right, tell us, what was your impression?
I can tell you this. If we ever needed proof that man was descended from lesser mammals, then Brother Cummings is that proof. Only the mammal is not the ape. Not the ape by a long shot. Horace Hall Cummings has descended from the fox, the shrewd, cunning fox.
Scene 7, setting the podium. At rise, Ralph continues his speech.
Now, admitting at the outset that each species of animals has been created, the question that is pertinent and proper is, by what method? This is a problem over which Darwin pondered, and the answer belongs to science. It does not touch the question, by whom, which belongs to theology.
Scene 8, setting, Smith's office. At rise, Smith sits behind a desk. Cummings stands before the desk.
Mr. Cummings, we cannot convey to you our dismay at hearing such news.
But what I found even more disturbing than that was the manner of my treatment when news of my visit spread across the campus.
We're listening.
Yes, well, always before, when visiting the campus, I had been treated with friendly, respectful spirit. That spirit this time was replaced with one of opposition and fault-finding. I discovered that both the faculty and the students alike were saying that I wanted to destroy the academic liberty of the school. But I've acquired some reputation of a blue-nosed killjoy, whose office is to detect and ferret out any rectitude, waywardness, and sin. I'm merely tolerated, except by college students seeking teaching positions in church schools. Students have struck back with some semi-ribald yarns regarding my ultra-piety and purity. For instance, begging your pardon, President, one tale claims that while traveling, I was unable to sleep in my hotel room after noticing a bathroom door from which two letters were missing, which read, "Women to Let." But you know, President Smith, that it has never been my intention to destroy the school. I was only following your orders to investigate charges of evolution and secular biblical teachings.
Your loyalty is not in question here, Brother Cummings. Please be sure of that. We are aware of the sentiments of the students whose parents took the time to write us, but what are the other students saying?
Well, the defenders argue that theological work has never been so interesting and well-patronized. The new thought is making a new school at BYU, they say.
New thought, old lies. Continue.
Well, because of the spirit of questioning, there are profound differences of opinion among both students and teachers upon many important points of doctrine and belief. Because the theory of evolution is treated as a demonstrated law, its application by these teachers to the gospel truths has given rise to many curious and conflicting explanations of Scripture.
We are interested in your opinion as to the possibilities of a resolution.
Conditions in Provo are currently unfavorable for a solution to this difficulty without intervention from church headquarters.
And what should we do, church headquarters, in your opinion, to nip this in the bud?
Yes. Well, if the teachers in question were separated or given other lines of work to do where their theories were not continually called into activity, I think their attitudes might eventually change for the better.
Scene 9, setting the podium. At Rise, Ralph continues his speech.
It is clear that the millions of kinds of living things that have existed did not come upon the earth simultaneously, but that they have appeared in long succession. Now, the question that must first be answered is, how were all the forms of life now living created? It is an old maxim that all life comes from life. Each one of us, every living thing, typically began as a very simple particle of organized matter in which, in a marvelous way, becomes gradually more and more complex until the highly complicated adult results. Such a development is termed evolution. Through such an evolution process, then, and according to definite laws, each individual living thing has today been created. This doctrine of descent or evolution demands an ultimate cause, and bold it is to pay a much greater tribute to the power and majesty of the Creator. For uniformity of method is an indication of strength, while irregularity of method is always a sign of weakness.
Scene 10, setting, Brimhall's office. At Rise, Brimhall stands looking out of a window in a door at Chamberlain and the Petersons in his waiting room. A sour expression is on his face, and he rubs his abdomen. Lights up on Flora, standing off to one side in Brimhall's office.
You'll have to see them eventually.
Flora? Flora, what are you doing here?
You brought me. Don't you remember?
Yes. Yes, I suppose I did. You always understood me best. How I wish you were really here.
But I am here, George. I mean, I may just be a chimera, but I'm here in the only way that really matters, in your heart.
What should I do, Flora?
You know what to do.
Yes. Yes, I know, but what will I say?
Tell them the truth, that they've been singled out by Superintendent Cummings.
They'll think I've turned traitor. I told Ralph I was on their side, that... and I would put in a good word for them. I even told them I was an evolutionist.
And are you an evolutionist?
Well, I don't know. So many great and learned men believe it. Who am I to say they're wrong? And Ralph has such a way of explaining it as to make any disagreement between science and religion non-existent.
Did you tell Ralph that part about how he explained things so well?
Well, I think I showed why he had too early when I expressed sympathy for his views. I can't appear to be too much on their side. I am the president of BYU, after all.
And that means what? A president must be aloof from those over whom he presides?
No, not aloof, really. I just... But there is the matter of authority. One must firmly plant the flag of one's authority and not retreat.
They make it sound like a war.
Oh, isn't it? War between old beliefs and new philosophies? Religious truth and scientific theory?
Does it have to be a war?
You always know the right thing to say, even when I conjure you up.
There's something else bothering you, isn't there?
Well, the last time you were here, when Ralph came in, I saw look passed between you.
It was nothing.
Were you fanning old embers?
George, how can you ask that after all these years?
Well, I'm not blind. But I'm 50 years old. Ralph is more your age. You have a history. You have more in common.
No, we don't. We don't have you in common, and that's all that matters to me. Did I ever tell you why I chose you over Ralph?
Well, I know I'm probably making this whole thing up anyway, but I'd like to hear it.
Ralph was very charming. There's no denying that. Handsome? Definitely. And as keen an intellect as one could imagine. But for all that Ralph was, there was no guarantee what Ralph would become. You, on the other hand, were a given. Your loyalty to the church had been proven time and time again. Your status was secured. Your ability to provide a wife with the key to eternal life, though I may not be your first wife, was beyond question. Ralph was an unknown. Would he remain loyal to the church? Probably, but I couldn't know for sure. Could he guarantee me exaltation in the celestial kingdom? Again, I couldn't be certain of that. Do you see what I'm saying?
Are you saying that's the only reason you married me?
No. It was the primary reason I was attracted to you in the first place. Love, that came later and stayed. I've got to go now, George. Please let me go. Your friends are waiting for you.
Lights out on Flora. Brimhall opens the door to his office. Ralph enters.
George, you don't know how close I've come to cold-cocking Henry while you've kept us waiting. He's been driving us crazy with his worry.
Why don't you just sit down and we'll talk about this like rational men. I'll get straight to the point, Ralph. In filing this report, Cummings named you and Henry and Joseph Peterson as the principal, culprits in what is affectionately known in church leadership circles as the BYU problem.
What else did the little weasel say in his report to them that he didn't in his report to the faculty?
Well, let me suggest that criticism of leaders should be kept in the background, especially at this institution. I urge you to be loyal to the heroes of Mormondom.
Mormondom is the exact phrase I was looking for. George, is the die cast? Can we offer more evidence in our favor? Many of the students have claimed how our teachings have increased their testimony. Well, if not that, then can we call for a general resolution of some kind, inviting the authorities of the church to appoint a committee to investigate the points of doctrine upon which we've been criticized?
No, I don't think that would be a good idea. It would surely give the brethren the idea that you were in a combative mode. If they interpret this as a war, well, there's no reason to do that. It doesn't have to be a war, does it?
I'm sorry, George. This makes me so angry. I can't see straight. Cummings has either intentionally mischaracterized our positions or he's too ignorant to understand what they truly are. When a man like him is so bound with prejudice and tradition that he's blind to the beauties and light of the grandest conception that science has yet won for man, you know what it reminds me of? Castelli. You remember Castelli? When the Pope was about to inflict punishment upon Galileo for his demonstration of the movements of the earth, Castelli pleads before him, "Your Holiness, nothing that can be done can now hinder the earth from moving."
Ralph, you have to cease such talk for your own good, really.
Why for my own good, George? Do you intend on running up to Salt Lake and tattling on us?
You know I won't do that. I'm on your side in this thing. I told you that already. I hired you three, remember? I wouldn't have done that if I didn't think you were the best for the school.
I guess we can content ourselves in the fact that whatever they do to us, they can't change the realities of Darwin's discoveries. Ultimate cause and meaning remain untouched and as impenetrable as before. Oh, yes. The survival of the fittest will yet save the day.
Act 2, Scene 1, Setting the Podium. At Rise, Ralph continues his speech.
The idea of evolution was, in a crude form, foreshadowed, even in the Babylonian records. The botanist Linnaeus, in the 18th century, first set afloat the extreme contrary view, according to which every particular kind of living thing had been specially molded in the hands of the Creator. And because of his great influence and the attractiveness with which he surrounded his works, His views for a considerable time were almost universally accepted. And, of course, in the hands of clergymen, soon took on a religious garb that has clouded the minds of so many good people even to this day, causing them to suppose that ideas originated in the mind of a man of science, ambitious for his own doctrine, represented the word of Scripture.
Applause from offstage. Ralph looks up. James E. Talmage enters, clapping his hands.
Dr. Talmage.
Talmage crosses to Ralph, extending his hand, which Ralph shakes with some trepidation. Lights down on podium. Ralph and Talmage are suspended in a pool of light. The dream sequence continues.
Don't be afraid, Ralph. I'm here to compliment you. Excellent speech so far.
Thank you.
Yeah, if the truth be told, I'm quite a fan of Charles Darwin myself.
You are?
A remarkable man. Keen intellect. Would have made a great Mormon, in my opinion.
So you really like the speech?
Yes, very much so. How far are you into
it? I'm on page 9, 5 more pages.
Oh, good. Yeah, that gives us some time to talk.
Talk? What do you want to talk about? What do I have to say to an apostle?
Nah, don't worry about that. It's what I have to say to you that matters. I understand that you'll be meeting with the Church Board of Education pretty soon, or at least a special committee comprised of some of my colleagues.
Yes, none of us had the slightest intimation that we'd been singled out. We talked about it on the train on the way up here, and we couldn't figure out why we were being summoned up to headquarters.
Shame on President Brimhall for not telling you.
And we all met with him just before we came up here. He had the perfect opportunity.
Now, calm down, Ralph. Calm down. Your temper can get you into trouble. A word of advice. When you meet with the brethren, try to control yourself. Can you promise me that?
I can't promise I'll succeed.
Now, just try. That's all I'm asking. Next time you feel to criticize George, ask yourself this question. Would you want to be in his shoes, dealing with a fellow like you?
Yes. I see what you mean. And no, I probably wouldn't.
See, what's happening here, Ralph, is a clash of authorities. That's really all it boils down to. The authority of science coming in direct conflict with the authority of religion.
I may not be a prophet, but even I know how that's going to turn out. Religion's going to win.
Well, not necessarily. There's been much discussion over the alleged conflict between the teachings of science and the doctrines of the revealed word concerning the origin of man. But you must remember that the term origin is almost invariably used in a relative sense. The mind of man is unable to grasp the fundamental thought of an absolute or primary origin. Every occurrence man has witnessed is the result of some previously acting cause or purpose, and that cause in turn was the effect or result of causes yet more remote. Perhaps we've never been able to trace an effect to its primary or original cause. Man may say that he understands the origin of an oak in the acorn form from which it sprang. But it's not the acorn, the fruit of a yet earlier oak, and so, in reality, rather a continuation than a beginning. Yet, there is something fascinating in the thought of a beginning. The persistence of a process once started is far less mysterious than its inception. You might want to take notes, young man. I'm giving you some excellent arguments in your favor.
Go on. Please tell me more.
Yes. It has been stated by certain extremists that evolution affirms that man is in the line of posterity from the ape. But scientists today actually discredit this view. The most that even radical evolutionists assert is that the similarity of structure between man and certain apes indicates the possibility of a common ancestor of the two, but between man and the ape, there are more essential differences than resemblances.
Yes, yes, I like it. Any other tidbits of wisdom?
Well, of course. I mean, you could remind the committee that none other than Brigham Young himself taught that geology was, what was his exact words, a true science, though he admitted that he did not necessarily believe all the conclusions of his professors were true in every case, and I quote, "Its leading principles are true. They are facts. They are eternal."
Oh, that's good, too.
Mm-hmm. And this one. You can mention that in 1909, the YWMMIA manual contained an article by Elder Widsoe wherein he defended the ancient age of the earth and that the creative days were of indefinite duration.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. You might want to emphasize evolution as an explanation of how God creates life. The fact that all created things are the works of God, and that all processes of nature are due to him as the administrator of law and order,
is to the scientific mind an axiom requiring neither argument nor demonstration. The botanist knows that God makes the plant grow, but he, weak mortal, is devoting time and energy of body, mind, and spirit to study of the way in which God works such a marvelous miracle. The geologist knows that God created the earth, but the best effort of his life is put forth in the hope of finding out in some degree, however small, the method by which the Creator wrought this wondrous world. The astronomer, gazing into the starry depths, sees in their orderly procession the Lord Eternal walking in his majesty and might. And in humility, the student of the heavenly bodies spends days and nights striving to learn a little of the way in which God worked out the marvel of the universe. In proportion as any one of these may learn of the ways of God, he becomes wise. To be able to think as God thinks, to comprehend in any degree his purposes and methods, is to become in that measure like unto him. And to that extent, to be prepared for eventual companionship in his presence. The scientist is busily engaged in the study of secondary causes, the ways and means by which God works and through which he accomplishes his miracles, ever beginning, never ending. And in his search for the truth, the student of science scarcely dares lift his eyes to look toward the first great cause, the eternal power that stands and operates behind and above all the secondary causes, or what we call the processes of nature. What is man in this boundless setting of sublime splendor? I answer you, potentially now, actually to be, he is greater and grander, more precious, according to the arithmetic of God, than all the planets and suns of space. For him were they created. They are the handiwork of God. But man is his son. In this world, man is given dominion over a few things, but it is his privilege to achieve supremacy over many things. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. Incomprehensibly grand as are the physical creations of the earth and space, they have been brought into existence as means to an end, necessary to the realization of the supreme purpose, which, in the words of the Creator, is thus declared, "For behold, this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. It is decreed that this earth shall become a celestialized, glorified sphere. Such is the revealed word. Science has nothing to say on the matter. It can neither refute nor prove. But the Lord, even God, hath spoken. So shall it be."
Talmadge stops, almost in tears, looks at Ralph, somewhat embarrassed at his waxing dramatic.
Amen.
Scene 2. Setting, Brimhall's office. At rise, Brimhall, lit only by the outside evening light, sits with his back to the room. A pause. Ralph hurries on, sees Brimhall, stops. Brimhall, without turning around, speaks. His voice is low and toneless.
What's the verdict?
I think you know, George. After all, didn't you tell the committee that, under the circumstances, you could not see your way clear to recommend any of us for continuing status?
I know that you are, from your point of view, perfectly right, but I think you're a little overzealous in your desire to bring people to your cause. I have labored with you in the hope that you would change your attitude and abstain from thrusting your objectionable views before the classes, but it seems that you are bound and determined to teach theology according to your own ideas instead of according to revealed truth.
Brimhall winces in pain.
George, what's the matter?
Nothing. It's just the stomach, you know. I'm better now.
His laugh turns into a groan. When he speaks, it is with obvious difficulty.
I can't say that you and your cohorts have made it any easier.
George, can I get you something? You're sweating. Let me get a wet towel for your forehead.
Ralph exits toward the bathroom. Brimhall turns around. He looks at the gun in his hand as if he's never seen it before. He opens a drawer, puts in the gun, closes the drawer, sits. Ralph comes back on with a wet towel, which he places on Brimhall's forehead after helping Brimhall lean his head back.
We've been having some little out-of-harmony conditions here, haven't we, Ralph?
Little out-of-harmony conditions. Euphemism certainly becomes you.
Oh, what a mess. It's the first time during my administration that I've had to handle a teacher in this way, and the necessity is very painful to me.
I'm sorry. I couldn't have been more accommodating.
Harmony.
I beg your pardon?
Harmony. That's my problem, Ralph. I think I would be in perfect misery if I were not in harmony with those above me. I don't know, Ralph, but there's something about me, being out of harmony with others, my peers or my subordinates, that doesn't bother me in the slightest. I've always tried to follow the interests of the faculty and the student body, but no one can expect me to follow either unless those interests are in perfect harmony with those over me. You see that, don't you, Ralph?
Yes, George, I see it.
And I've been on your side throughout most of this affair, haven't I been, Ralph?
Most of the time, I think.
Ralph, why can't you just teach the subject the way they want it taught instead of the way you're teaching it?
I can't teach what I don't believe.
I want you to stay. You want to stay, don't you?
Yes, of course I do.
Well, if you'll stay and work with me, there isn't anything in the gifts of the church you can't have. I'm asking you, Ralph, to conform to the board's decisions. Stop teaching all that modern thought.
I'm sorry, George. You know I can't do that.
I don't look for a safe reconciliation. Come, come, ye saints. No toil, nor labor, fear. That's it, Ralph. Don't you see? That's the solution to our problem. Do you see what I'm getting at? The saints who sang that hymn, they didn't have all this modernism to think about. Things were so simple. No one had even heard of Charles Darwin back then. Do you think that's it, Ralph? Do you think I was born a century too late?
That could be. I know I've been thinking of late that I was born a century too early.
I talked to Reed Smoot about this, Ralph. I asked him what I should do. You know what he told me? The apostle of the Lord told me, your only safety lies in having the school follow strictly the policy mapped out for the teachers of the school. You know what you're doing, Ralph? You and Henry and Joseph, you're dictating to the prophets.
I'm not dictating to anyone. I'm asking for the right to teach a subject as my conscience and my heart tell me I should teach it.
Brimhall starts pacing like a caged animal.
I've been hoping for a year or two past that harmony, that we could have harmony if I just waited. But the delays have been fraught with increased danger. The school cannot go off and leave the church in any line of activity without perishing in the desert. I see it now, Ralph. I see it as clear as I've seen anything. It is crystal clear to me what I should have done. A more vigorous course of action on my part might have been better. Yes, yes, you know, that would have been much better. More vigor. But no, I was... I was lenient. I was patient. I was hopeful that men would change gradually as they have done in other cases. I did it, Ralph. I've changed when they stopped polygamy. I did an about face. I didn't even think twice about it. The prophet had spoken. That's all I needed. I had a change of heart, Ralph. Why can't you? Why, Ralph? So that was where I went wrong. In the waiting, in expecting you to change your mind. The storm, instead of dying out, increased its fury.
Brimhall seems to address an unseen audience.
I feel now that nothing short of a public retraction could be accepted as a guarantee that these men will preserve an attitude of being in harmony with the spirit of the school and the doctrines of the churches preached by the living oracles.
There are some people who predict the death of the college if these men go on. I am ready to say that if the life of the college depends upon any number of men out of harmony with the brethren who preside over the church, then it is time for the college to die.
A wave of pain nearly doubles him over. Ralph rushes to his side, helps him to sit once again. A few deep breaths and he goes on, still addressing the unseen audience.
I would rather the Mazer Memorial remain a sealed tomb containing our college hopes and ambitions until the day of a new educational resurrection than to have its doors thrown open to influences antagonistic to the heroism, inspiration, and revelation of those who have made this school and who have the right to say, thus far shalt thou go and no farther. The school follows the church, or it ought to stop.
Out of his reverie, he looks at Ralph.
Ralph, did I ever tell you about my dream?
No. And I would like very much to hear it.
In the dream, I saw several BYU professors standing around a peculiar machine on the campus. When one of them touched a spring, what was it? It looked like a baited fish hook that was attached to this long, long, thin wire that rose rapidly into the air. What was this, the fishing in the air? But what could be caught in that way? I looked into the sky, and I saw this flock of snow-white birds circling among the clouds and frolicking in the sky. They seemed so happy, that these snow-white birds. And one of the birds, sees the bait on the hook. He darts towards it, grabs it, and one of the professors touches a spring in the machine, and whoosh! The wire shoots out of the end of the machine and snags the bird, hauls it down to the earth. Then all of a sudden, the bird is no longer a bird. On reaching the ground, the bird proved to be a BYU student, clad in an ancient Greek costume. One of the professors directed the student to join a group of other students who had been brought down in a similar manner. I walked over to them, noticed that all of them looked very sad and downcast. Why, students? Why, I asked. What on earth makes you so sad and downhearted? Alas, we can never fly again, they replied with a sigh, and a sad shake of the head. Do you see the meaning of the dream, Ralph? Shall I be Daniel and interpret my own dream for you? It was their Greek philosophy, you see, that had tied them to the earth, the Greek philosophy that you and the others taught them. They could believe only what they could demonstrate in the laboratory. Their prayers could go no higher than the ceiling. They could see no heaven, no hereafter.
He falls to his knees in pain, the worst attack yet. Ralph rushed to his side, taking him in his arms.
George, I'm not the one preventing them from flying. If you can bring me one student whose faith I have injured in Mormonism, I will bring you five that you, through your narrowness, have driven out of the church. I never gave a public lecture on evolution until I had consulted you as to whether it would be all right. You urged me to do it, George. Now, why did you change so suddenly?
Tell you, Brother Chamberlain, I know which side my bread is buttered on. Go back to your party, Ralph. Go back to your friends. You deserve it. Them. I'll miss you.
You sure you'll be all right?
All right. Yes, I'll be all right. I'll make things right.
A pause. Ralph leaves silently.
Say goodbye to Flora for me.
Brimhall turns, sees that Ralph is not in the room. He looks at the desk. He goes to the desk, opens the drawer, looks in it. Slowly, he removes the gun, looks at it. He raises the gun to his mouth. Blackout. In the darkness, we hear a gunshot. Scene 3. Setting, the podium. At rise, underscored by the melody of Praise to the Man, Ralph finishes his speech.
The genuine delight which he took in helping everyone in his work, often at the cost of much inconvenience to himself, as in kindling the enthusiasm of the humblest tyro in science, was the outcome of a great and generous self. The modesty with which he regarded his own work was no less remarkable than his readiness and enthusiastically to admire the work of others. For no one was so unconscious of Mr. Darwin's worth as Mr. Darwin himself. It has been said that those favored few who were on terms of intimate friendship with him, any language by which it might be sought to portray his character must seem inadequate. Whatever is great and whatever is good in human nature found him, in him so luxuriant a development that we left no place or chance for any other growth. And in the result was seen a magnificence which, unless actually realized, we should scarcely be able to imagine it. It is therefore not surprising that no man ever passed away leaving behind him a greater void of enmity or a depth of adoring friendship more profound. And thus remarkable as were the mental endowments that enabled Darwin to accomplish the works in secular history that more than anything else made the 19th century illustrious, we see that in him the highest moral qualities rose preeminently over the intellectual, and that Darwin was the greatest naturalist through the sheer greatness of his soul. Let me close by quoting the last sentence in Darwin's Origin of the Species. It is strikingly appropriate to the momentous occasion at which we find ourselves presently today. Speaking of his overarching view of the unity of life, he said, "There is a grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one, and that while this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved."
He sets aside the speech.
If I may be permitted a personal epilogue, I wish to express my undying gratitude to the president of this university, George Brimhall, for the opportunity to teach at this august institution. President Brimhall's far-seeing vision, as evidenced by his efforts to upgrade the teaching faculty and to allow more open discussion on such topics as communism, eugenics, etc., will help to one day mold the Brigham Young University into one of the world's greatest institutions of higher learning, to bring it into more perfect harmony with the words of Joseph Smith when he said, "One of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is to receive truth, let it come from whence it may."
Begin slow fade on podium, then special up slow on Darwin sign. Blackout. The end.
A few minutes left. We entertain any comments, questions, suggestions that anybody might have. He did, not at this time. I telescoped that into the story, but he did it 11 years later. He'd had a the stomach pains were real. He had they don't even know quite what it was, with medical science being what it was then. But he'd been tortured with that for a long time. At the end of his life, he was actually pretty much out of it, in pain and agony, and tried to kill himself on several occasions, and his family held him in kind of in quarantine, and were supposed to, you know, round the clock watching him to make sure he didn't do what he tried to do before. And one day, one of his family members decided to do some shopping, figuring he was asleep, they could do it and come back in time. And while they were gone, he found the gun that they'd hit and killed himself. It was about 11 years after this incident and when he'd left BYU and was no longer the president of the university at the time. Any other questions? Yes.
At the beginning, as you introduced and changed the format, I think you suggested that you had cut your play in order to get on and go early to lunch. I want to know where can I read or hear the whole thing? How much has gone from it?
It's actually twice as long as this. It's more than twice as long. We read this the first time Saturday night to rehearse to prepare for this, and the first act was 2 hours long. And we thought, we better cut this down or they'll never ask us back again. So the play will be revised and will be eventually 2 hours long. And it'll be published. This man over here is going to publish it for me, I think, if he likes it. And it'll be available in script form for a while, and then we're going to try to find some place. Maybe BYU will produce it. I don't know. But
the entire thing we will not hear because you will have cut even your finish?
Yes, because, well, frankly, most of it was overwritten, actually. And we'll cut it down to 2 hours, but there's more. You can see the other two men, Henry and Joseph Peterson, have a little bit more to do. There's a whole scene we cut out where it takes place with the three of them in front of six apostles, kind of an inquisition scene, if you will. We cut that because we don't have 12 men to read the part. So, but in the real play, that'll be put back in. Another comment? It's like 99% fact. Most of the lines that we put her in because there were no women in the story. I didn't want to play with 15 men. I mean,
yeah. Romantic interest. Was there a romance between Ford and Ralph, or did you?
That was fictional too, but the lines that Ralph said, the lines Cummings said, the lines that President Smith said, that's all right out of the historical record. And all I did it actually happened over several. They had several meetings, for instance, with Cummings, and I made it all happen into one for dramatic purposes. But most of those lines, especially Talmadge's long speech, for instance, is actually something he wrote, and that's fictional too because he didn't say this till 20 years later. But we brought it into the play because we wanted to find a high-ranking authority that had something nice to say about evolution, and that was hard to find in 1909. So I had to jump 30 years in the future to find somebody. Okay, question. Another comment? Oh, okay. But again, back to Brimhall's thing, and I'll get you in a second. My research showed me that he was bothered a lot by what he had to do to these young men. So the idea of him feeling stressed and emotional about having to fire these guys, that was real. And it plagued him till the day he died. He felt like he was a traitor the whole time because he was. It was his attempt to make BYU a real university. It had been a high school essentially before, and so he felt bad about that. He had to turn on his three first PhDs. So that egged at him his entire life. Another comment.
Yeah. Now, if I remember right, you wrote this a long time ago. First draft of it. Is that right?
Yes. I've learned that the Flores relationship with the story is much more interesting than the one I made up. She was Brimhall's second wife, but their marriage was not quite as romantic, I guess, as I made it look. It turns out that Brimhall's wife was experiencing, I don't know exactly what the condition she has, but she was pretty much going out and, out of it herself and had essentially relinquished the wifely duties, if you will, and was kind of going nuts herself and told Brimhall, if you want this, you'll have to find some other woman to do this for you. Go find another wife. And so he found one, and it was Flora. And also, I believe, I have to go back and check my research on this, but I think the marriage was performed after the official banning of it in the United States. It was after 1899 or whenever. It was somewhere in the early 1900s where it was technically illegal to do it, but he did it anyway. I don't know that yet. I'll have to look into that.
The leader of the church?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it was one of those official but unspoken of marriages that happened a lot. There were some legal marriages done as late as 1910, I think, as far as the church was concerned, but which they held, you know, they were quiet about to the world at large, and not apparently to the church at large too, because a lot of people have actually believed that we stopped polygamy when Wolford would have said we would, but it took us a decade to figure that out. So, any other comments?
What was his relationship before Abigail's wife? She still. They
remained close. You know, she was like she took the place of the other one in many ways. No. This woman here is related to Flora, which I didn't find out. Right?
Yes.
Which I didn't find out until I cast her. But Flora, Fawn Brody works into this story somehow. How is Fawn Brody related to Flora? Why don't you tell them that story?
You really want to know that one?
Yeah. I found this after I wrote the paper, so I'm going to go back and revise it with all this new stuff.
Well, I'm not going to tell all the family secrets, but... Flora had some children, and one of her child's name was Fawn, and she married Thomas E. McKay. And Thomas E. McKay and Flora had four girls and a son. The son is my father. And the other girls are Fawn, Brody, and Flora, another Flora, and Barbara and Louise. So that's how that fits in. And the rest of the secrets remain that way.
Next year.
That's the version two. Any other comments? Yes.
Just a question. When it's produced, are you going to do it probably here in Utah? How do you know about it?
I'll try to do my best to let you know about it. We'll try to do it in Utah someplace.
Very timely.
I have some professors at BYU reading it, but I have no serious, you know, ideas that they're going to actually produce it. They like it, but their hands are tied down there too. For obviously, yeah. Another comment. This is Ralph Chamberlain's granddaughter.
That's my granddaughter speaking.
Oh. Okay. What happened to him?
He came back up to the University of Utah and taught biology.
Did he remain active in the LDS church?
No.
See, I did not know that part. I did not know that part.
Repeat it
for the tape. Ralph Chamberlain's granddaughter in our audience said that he stayed and taught biology at BYU.
I mean
at the University of Utah, yeah. And did not remain active in the church.
Didn't he go up to Brigham Young College? Wasn't he hired?
That was
his brother?
Yeah, that was his brother.
Okay.
William.
William W.
Some of the lines that I have Ralph speak were actually William's lines. He wrote more about evolution and its relationships to religion than Ralph did, and the reason Ralph is kind of the protagonist is because of the speech he gave in 1909. I wanted to create like a framework where he's giving this speech. If you can imagine today, a speech at BYU on Darwin. I mean, it's like almost a fantasy, but it happened in 1909, and the school. It was widely attended by the school and. And so I wanted the irony of that is what I wanted to show, that he was given this great speech. At the same time, 3 years later, he was out of there like he'd been teaching false doctrine, which I guess they thought he was.
There. How long was it before they had any more PhD professors
come? Not for a while. I don't think not for Brimhall's reign. It was a couple years that he left after this, but these were the Harvey Fletcher, who was a character in the full length play. left BYU over this. A lot of teachers left BYU, went to other places. And that it was a long time. It was like, boy, into the early 1920s, I think, before a new set of PhDs came in.
So Harry Fletcher left BYU over this, but they have a building named after him and everything.
Yeah, but...
Wow. I think one thing that's kind of interesting is, at the time, it's always difficult for us to go back and put ourselves in the mindset of 1909. And personally, I don't find BYU's reaction to this all that unusual, nor do I find it really distasteful. I mean, they have a right to run the university however they see fit. It's a private university. And I think if we go back in time, you know, a lot of us will recall the Monkey Scopes trials. I believe those took place in the 20s, didn't they?
Yeah, it was after this.
Yeah, it was well after this. And, of course, that had nothing to do with BYU or anything like that. I think there was a large movement in the United States, a religious movement, certainly at the turn of the century and well into the 20s, 30s, 40s, that this movement was in direct opposition to a lot of the findings or at least hypotheses of Darwin. And so I think it altogether normal that the general authorities and the, you know, a lot of the people would react the way that was put forth in this play. And, you know, I don't know, but I mean, I think evolution is taught at BYU today.
Yes, but under duress.
Well,
about every two or three years, they got to re-explain themselves. But it is taught, and, but it's...
As long as it's taught as a theory. Not as a fact.
Exactly.
I think that we should remember that it is a theory.
Well said.
I don't think that I don't think there's any definitive work on the origin of man, other than Darwin's theory and other theories perhaps. I also think it's interesting to point out that Darwin, as I recall, and I have not studied it in depth, put forth the hypothesis that, okay, here's what I consider to be evolution, boom, 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 up to the ape, and here's man, and I have no idea what happened in between. And so that's the old missing link thing that we keep, you know, we find some frozen guy in South America or, you know, something else up in Antarctica or something like that, that there's always this thing about the missing link. I think science has yet to really definitively nail down the origin of man. And I find that fascinating. I think Talmadge pointed that out.
He does.
And I just want to put my two cents in that Mormons aren't the only ones who had problems with Darwin's theories, and also to remember that they are theories.
I'd like to ask a question of some of you. My intent in doing this play was to kind of walk the middle of the road here. I wanted to show that that Ralph had a lot to say, but he also was not a perfect person, and I wanted to show that Brimhall was kind of the same way. It was not my intention to take sides on this play, on the show, because then it ceases to be theater and becomes polemic, and that's not the purpose of theater. Theater is to entertain and make you think. If I were to take a position where I beat you over the head to believe one way or the other, I'd be doing missionary work, and that's not what plays are about. So. Your impression of that roughly is that, you know, do you come away thinking, man, that Ralph guy is smart and the church is idiots, or BYU's great and Ralph's dumb, or they both got pros and cons? Yes.
I thought that the presentation of George Brimhall was excellent, and I felt myself being sympathetic to his position as well as Ralph. The place where it broke down and I was almost shocked and was when he said, "I know what side my bread is buttered on." I thought that was open prostitution of his position. It almost became deceptive. I felt like I'd been deceived by what he'd been talking to me about for all of his speeches up to that point. I just that line really, I think, changed my perception towards Brimhall.
That's an actual line. He said that too, unfortunately.
I didn't say that.
She did.
We
have no tape.
Of the struggle of conscience
Yeah, they each followed their own authority is what they did. Brimhall, the authority was the hierarchy. Ralph, it was his science. And so you have two guys with the same decision that they made.
Was it Ralph's science or was it his reconciliation of science and religion? I mean, was it all true?
Yeah, the impression I get is Ralph didn't see a conflict.
And just to go along comment with Mike's like that, I think that Ralph's position is the more widely accepted one now in the church. Evolution has been folded into part of God's plan and is not really a problem for most people. Like you said, it's a theory and it's...
No.
Maybe not.
How strongly did Ralph actually teach evolution? Did he teach it more as a fact, thereby understandably arousing the ire of the general authority? Or were the general authorities more conservative in those days, and then they had to wait 30 years until the big debate between Joseph Fielding Smith and B.H. Roberts before they finally came to the conclusion, well, you know, let's not worry about this quite so much?
He did teach it as fact, from what I could tell. He was pretty much convinced it was the way to do things, and was actually kind of surprised that when he came back that there were people that didn't think that, you know, which is sometimes something that happens to you when you gain a chunk of knowledge and come back and teach it to a bunch of other people and they don't have the training you have. It's a little hard to, you kind of like assume that they ought to know because it's so obvious to you.